Okay, so this is a talk about, I probably shouldn't skip the title slide. This is open source software and its role in space exploration. The quicker among you will be wondering, gee, if it's open source software, why are we looking at PowerPoint? We'll get, you're allowed to wonder that, and we'll get to it later. You are. So, to set the stage, open source software developers and NASA, as I see it, kind of have a common charter. We're both, broadly speaking, trying to accomplish the same thing. We want society to have more information. We want there to be a free exchange of information, of what is known. In the NASA charter, and I had to look it up because the 1958 wording got changed lately, but you see it says right up there someplace, provide for the widest practical and appropriate dissemination of information. So, you know, there it is, your tax dollars at work. What could be more open source than that? Both communities, as I see it, are focused on the cutting edge. Very few open source projects are reinventing any wheels because why would you? It's already there. You just grab it and use that and go on and do the next hard thing. You would fill the niche. If there's something you want that isn't out there, you go make it and then share it back. What NASA gives back is not code, but information about climate change, basic science, and general knowledge. So it's a little give and take. NASA can give code back, but as we'll see a little bit, it's very onerous because it's government money. So, oh yeah, you can make that open source here. You just got to fill out these forms and run it by these people, and about literally 2 years later, it'll be available. Well, anyway, so who am I? Why am I here? I'm here because Moose made me be here. We all know that. I'm a software geek, many languages, whatever platform they've got. And one thing I discovered working at the Jet Propulsion Lab, I should mention, that's the NASA center that does the robotic exploration. So nothing to do with astronauts. I don't know nothing from no people. But if it's pretty much we were told, stay away from Earth. And aside from that banishment, we can have the other planets. So any of the details about Neptune, Uranus, Saturn, Jupiter, those came out of the Jet Propulsion Lab in one form or another. Consequently, we have I have yet to discover a type of computer that's not at JPL, and that's because a mission gets started, gets funding, buys the latest cool toy, and then holds on to it through end of mission. Voyager launched in 77. I was walking through our machine room one day, and literally, I'm just walking down the hallway, and within the space of a short thing, I walked past the Cray supercomputer. You know, we had one of those. Then I walked past the card reader. Then the Touchstone Delta Hypercube and the Connection 5, the thing with all the little red LEDs that its host name was Blinky. So you have to be flexible, I guess is what I'm saying. You work on a system and then it never dies. Although my current job is to work on the landing radar on the 2009 Mars rover. So I'm going to work for a year. The software needs with a capital N, to work for 3 minutes. And then I'll never work on that project again, one way or another. Whether I work on the next project depends on how well I do in those 3 minutes. I've been a sysadmin, I've been a system engineer, and I'm back to being a programmer. I became a sysadmin because I was trying to write ground software, and I was spending all my time like compiling X11 and administering my Sonos machine. And gee, that's great, but you know, it takes a lot of time away, and maybe if someone did it for the whole group, then we didn't really have an IT department except for the supercomputers. So that's who I am. Open source in space. And this talk is, I restricted myself to examples that I had firsthand knowledge of or had lunch with someone who had firsthand knowledge of. So there's an awful lot of examples. I'm just going to stick with a few that I can speak to personally. Open source software is used to explore the solar system. It's used to observe the universe. It's used to develop new algorithms and code. It's used to move and analyze data once we get it. Why? What's the advantage? JPL in particular is actually a FFRDC, Federally Funded Research and Development Center. That means not only do we have government regulations, we're also part of Caltech, which means we have the educational regulations, which is sometimes to advantage. When we do put out a contract, we ask people, what's your government rate? They say, well, who are you? We say, well, what's your government rate and what's your educational discount? And they tell us, and then we tell them who we are. And sometimes we tell them NASA, and sometimes we tell them Caltech. Nevertheless, procurement cycles are very long. And it's hard to do something quickly. Our project life cycles are getting shorter. JPL, I think, launched two projects in the decade of the 1980s, and we launched six last year, so we're having to move an awful lot faster than we used to. Bug fix turnarounds are just enormously fast in the open source software. When the Unix clock, how many people in this room were affected, I should ask, by the Unix clock rolling over? Nobody. Alf, you were affected. Come on. When it went from 31 bits to 32 bits to represent the number of seconds since 1970? I asked when the Unix clock rolled over and who was affected by it. All right. Well, that story's going nowhere, so never mind. And feature additions. We get software that's almost right, and you know, you have to tweak it a little bit. And for reliability, we are at the kind of at and beyond the border cases. When we use software, we tend to push it. When the Pentiums came out with a hardware chip a while ago and the floating point error, yeah, and it was something like, oh, you know, the 30th decimal place will be off. Who cares about that? And we actually went back and said what it would do to our Mars probe. You know, it's the difference between... turns out we crashed it anyway, but that was a different probe. And it wasn't Intel's fault. But those errors do have consequences, and we can't tolerate them. Or, sure, that joke got a laugh. It wasn't a joke. So we tend to get software, we push it to its border, and we find out where it breaks, and then we either have to back off and say, don't use the software that way, you operations guide, or we have to modify the code. If it's proprietary code, that means we have to specify in advance very carefully exactly what feature we want. They come back with a cost estimate, and then we say yes, and then we realize what we really want. And you know, you've got contract negotiations quite properly involved in this cycle. Some vendors go out of their way, frankly, and really bend over backwards to help us. The open source community always does. I'll share one example of commercial people bending over backwards. The NASA website was upgraded. I didn't do it, but I do know the guy who did. So on a Friday night, they did the cutover. It had been some box under a guy's desk, you know, www.nasa.gov. They said, no, let's do a real infrastructure here, and the administrator's giving a speech on Monday. We'll do the cutover Friday night. We'll test it all weekend, yada, yada. So they stay up till Friday. They do the cutover, and this is to a real commercial infrastructure, mirror sites and applications, data hosting. And that was 6 hours before Columbia exploded. So the testing they were going to do, in case anybody wanted to tune into the webcast on Monday of some government official giving a speech, the way my friend found out that Columbia exploded, he got a phone call from the service provider, you know, 9 hours after they switched it over, saying, you know that year's worth of bandwidth you bought? It's gone. You know our next service level? It's gone. The service level after that? You're pushing it. Don't worry. You can have it. It's yours. We're going to need to redo this contract thing. We'll let the paperwork follow. But my God, wow, did they step up. Usually, though, the vendor's got us at that point. If it's open source, you've got a little more control. If the vendor wants to do something with you, they can. Interoperability and portability are very, very, very important. NASA projects. How do you build a NASA project? And we're in Washington, D.C., so think about it. You want to build a spacecraft. What's the first thing you do? You find out how to send money to at least 50 congressional districts. Which means you partner with industry. You partner with academia. You get the University of Arizona to do your image processing. You get your camera from Maryland. If at all possible, you get... Spread the joy. Spread the love. What does this mean? It means you can't easily dictate a platform because this contractor is a Sun shop, and they use HP, and they use Linux, and they're academic. They use 386s running Linux, and you want them all to work together. So interoperability, visibility, openness, portability is key because software written in one person's environment will probably get ported to someone else's. The development folks will turn it over to operations, which I really like Tom's talk, the talk before this, when he talked about, oh, yeah, the developers move on to operations. That is so smart. I wish we did it. We don't. Operational lifetimes, as I mentioned, can be decades. We do still run code that was written a very long time ago because the project doesn't have a budget to maintain it. There is no five-year funding for Voyager to upgrade its computing infrastructure. We barely have enough to keep sending the radio signals to it. Just that's it.
ITAR.
ITAR. Nobody likes ITAR. So we have all these industry partners. Cassini orbiting Saturn, for instance, is working with 12 different countries. And at one point, JPL got a new ITAR officer and said, well, you can't share this data about the probe with the Europeans. We said they built the probe. We're not really telling them anything they don't know. Well, what you're giving them is science information on Titan's atmosphere, and they don't need to know that right away. Their probe is dropping into it in about a week. They kind of need to know. That got worked out, but ultimately we had an export control officer sitting in the teleconferences. When someone would update their slides, they'd hand them to the officer who would clear them for release at the telecon they were sitting in. They're working on that. So, where was I going with that? If it's open source code, we can just tell them, go download it. When we first rolled out SSH, you know, a decade or something ago, we couldn't put it on our servers in Australia, which is, you have the deep space network, you're communicating with spacecraft, the Earth has this really annoying habit of rotating. So your antenna in California can only see a spacecraft for about a third of the day. So where do you put other antennas? A third of the way around the globe. In deserts, because the water interferes with the signal, preferably surrounded by mountains to shield them from cell phones, and in a politically friendly environment. So eventually you have to remotely administer these things, and you want to put SSH on them, and you can't, I kid you not, you can't go to Finland and download the code and compile it and then put it on the Australian machine, because that would be exporting encryption technology. I'm told all this has changed, but not for the better. But you can telnet to Australia, download the code from Finland, and compile it there, which gets it done. And, you know, as soon as somebody thought of that, we were finished. If it was, so that's an open source advantage. If we do change it, then we get all the controls for what we modified. The cost question. I think most people have figured this out by now. You can't go to management and sell them and say, wow, you know, we get this code for free. It's a cost advantage because management's pretty savvy and they say, you know, I could spend $400 for software that's going to take you a week to install. I just don't care about the acquisition cost. I want to know how long does it take to learn. I want to know how long does it take to test. When you write the procedures for using it, that's where all the money's going to go. Confidence in the future. I, as a developer, I like having the source code. If something goes wrong, I want to be able to find out exactly where. I want to look at the dump file and take it back to a line of code. Managers have the same desire I do. They want confidence that a year from now we can support this thing, but their warm and fuzzy, their security blanket is support contracts, which is why I'm very glad to see the Cygnus of the world, see Nominee, companies who will provide, it's weird. All they really have to do is take our money and provide an 800 number, and management's happy. If they actually provide excellent technical support, which I have found to be the case, that's kind of a bonus. You know, that's not necessary. Although I like it. And I put that third bullet on there just for the heck of it. Managers also get the warm fuzzies from certification, you know. Do you have 20 years of Unix experience? I don't care. Do you have that little, you know, that thing that the CNE or the MSE or whatever it is? And I have seen someone hired as a Unix administrator because they had the Microsoft certification over someone who just, you know, hacked Linux code because they weren't certified. CMMI is the current big thing at JPL. If you have that stamp, life is good. Unfortunately, it's an expensive stamp to get. I will volunteer that I'm going through the process of getting that stamp put on our project, and I found it to be useful. It's a lot of work. It finds a lot of detail. It's tedious detail, finding things that you overlooked, so I found it worthwhile. NASA software policy. This is sort of background. This is the guidance at headquarters gives us, and it's actually a pretty short document. You could go look at it if you wanted to, but some relevant expert. Requiring software providers to have proven organizational capabilities. How does that work with free and open software? I don't know. Onto within budget. You don't have a budget. Does that make it easier or harder? Gee, I don't know. Release it, blah, blah, blah. Now I'm bored. Okay, so what are some examples? And what I'm going to do for the rest, that's against that background, what is some of the work that NASA, JPL primarily, specifically to my experience, where the open source software is making things happen. Clarity, coupled layer architecture for robotic autonomy. These are people who notice that there are a lot of robotic efforts going on worldwide, obviously. There are whole conferences to it. But at JPL, we have the rovers. When you're trying to figure out how to explore Mars, story I heard recently, there's a whole bunch of rocks. How do you get over them? Easiest way, big tires. So we had this idea for a rover that had tires that were about a meter and a half tall, and a whole new suspension system that could let you deal with tires that way. So somebody went home to his garage, built a scale model that was about this, much smaller, about a 2/5 scale model, showed it to a manager in a meeting. The manager said, great, fly that, but I want that scale. Make it small. It was a good suspension system. That became the 97 Pathfinder rover. You might want to explore Mars by a balloon, which heats up during the day when the sun shines on it, carries your instrument package somewhere else on Mars, you don't care, follows the winds, and then settles at night when it gets cold and takes its measurements. That's a different kind of robot. A walking robot, rolling robots, so many kinds. And pretty much every group that's working on those tends to start from scratch. And there's a lot of infrastructure stuff. Room full of sysadmins can understand commonality very quickly. The Clarity project exists to provide a reusable base of technologies to be used for robotic work. This is a pretty picture of it. This is a sample of some of the robots they work with. So their goal is working with other people. They work with the key challenges. Key challenges, different physical characteristics, hardware, contributions by multiple institutions. You want to work with Carnegie Mellon. You want to work with Stanford. They won the DARPA challenge. The two front runners. You want lots of institutions to donate what they've learned and have it be reused by others. There is no common low-cost robotic platforms, although I'm very impressed with the high school challenge. The first robotics competitions are making some good inroads on that. They'll put a package together, send it out to high schools who will send robots in a competition. Software has to be free. How do they do that? The Clarity examples include next-generation Mars rovers, and I show some of the institutes that work on just one of the models that I've seen. They take their test images from Spirit and Opportunity, the real rovers, put them in an AFS, which is access controlled, of course, and Kerberized, and then every institution can see those test images, build their code test their code with it, see if they get the same path computation. Given this photograph, where are the rocks? Where would we drive to? Which ones would we choose to sample? The code they use, that reusable code base, is also kept in AFS, in a concurrent versioning system, file system, and something called YAM that I guess was developed for Clarity, but again is open source. So anyone who wants to join this collaboration, has a new algorithm, wants to try it out, it's on a global file system. It's using open source standards. All you need is the access control, and everything the place has done so far is immediately available to you at your home institution on your platform. You develop on Windows, Macintosh, Solaris, HP, Linux, whatever. It's all there. Go get it. Very easy to get started with. And I was touring around Ames once, and they had a model of the rover, lifted up the solar panel. There's a little laptop inside running Linux and AFS. And they said, yeah, well, you know, we just needed this little development thing to go around, and that was quick and easy to do. I thought it was the greatest thing I'd ever seen. If we had been using a proprietary system, every one of these little labs would say, oh, sure, you just need a CAD-CAM license and the integrated development environment license, and we'll have to get all of these things that you probably can't afford if you're a grad student. I've got four videos to show of the Clarity work working. Start with the first one. So this is, and these videos take you through a sequence of some of the work they've done. This one shows a completely virtual model trying to work out, okay, given a map of the terrain, how can I move my rover through it? How can I decide what's a safe path that won't drop my rover off a cliff? What's an interesting thing to go to? And you see the on the left side is a picture of what it would look like to you and me. On the right is just a color-coded safe path indication that was generated from that. So now out in the real world, we've got a rover downloads that software and runs around. This is about two buildings down from me. You can see from the, you can see how much caffeine we drink at JPL by how quickly the people are walking behind the rover. That's how we get so much work done. Better, faster, cheaper, now. You'd think that, I've never understood why companies don't just put free coffee up, why every section has to have their own, you know, 25 cents a cup. And this is successful. That's why they put it on their website. Because it sees rocks, it navigates. It's actually nothing interesting in that. I should turn the sound off. I'm sorry. It'd be pretty funny if it was narrated at the speed that people are walking past, wouldn't it? Backing up some of its software, fault detection, if it reaches a state it wasn't used to, like it's starting to tilt, stop, go back. Okay, so that's movement. Having moved, how do you place an instrument? So you might have an instrument on the end of an arm, and the goal, it's been told now, is get me a sample from an interesting rock. And this is the Mars yard where we fake all of that footage. I mean, where they... It is funny. We got these test labs all. There's a building labeled Extraterrestrial Material Simulation Laboratory, and their job is to figure out what blend of rocks and things do you need so that when the rover's out there, you know, are the wheels going to slip? Well, I don't know. Is it on rock? Is it on sand? It's on Mars sand, which is over Mars rock. And they go to Arizona and they get the right kind of rock and they chop it all up and they say, okay, there's an authentic environment. And so there you saw the arm being placed. So we've got all these rovers running around, but they have limitations. Like they can't go between two big boulders, they'd get caught. And somebody had the really bright idea. How do we deal with that? If you've got all, you've already sent all that mass to the planet, you need to get around. And this is about a 3-minute video of a robotics worker from Japan, again working with the Clarity set. So they had an idea. They were able to take the existing platforms, some of the existing stuff, and you see how the wheel just kind of separates itself out. It just pops out of the rover. Somebody realized that a Mars rover doesn't have to be the whole package. It doesn't need to have the ability to communicate directly to Earth. It doesn't need a big power source. It doesn't need all of that radio stuff if its lander has it. It's so cute. So the wheel just detaches. It uses the arm, which it was attaching it to the rover, has a separate little guidance wheel on the back so it can roll itself around. Thinking outside. So consider what this thing has to know. You see it weaving between rocks here. It doesn't have a camera. How does it know the rocks are there? And I guess you could put whiskers or sensors on it. Most likely it's being controlled. And the answer is I don't know. But I've got the microphone so I can make up any story I want. It's probably being controlled by the rover. It's got a little wireless antenna on it, and the rover is sort of telling its hand. They used to do this in the Saturday morning cartoons. You know, the robot would detach its hand, and then it would tell the hand what to do. They do that in zombie movies as well, I guess. Here it's found a nice small sample that's interesting. One thing a Mars rover can't do is get little chips of interesting rock that are outside its reach, so send the little drone to do it. I also think of the old Speed Racer. The Mach 5 had that robotic drone it would send off. You can just imagine what are all the what-if questions, right? Well, what if it did have sensors? What if it was thinking for itself? What if it was one of these little autonomous, like ants, that could just always follow the right hand unless you encounter something, then turn 15 degrees left and keep trying? all of those what-if questions that you want to experiment with, and you've got the full capability of all the robotic infrastructure that was sent, established, available for reference or modification. You wouldn't want to design a whole new sensor code set from scratch. If just because you added a sensor, you'd say, well, if I added a camera like those Stanford people had, how would that work? This idea of docking two of them together is pretty great, because now they've got the mobility of two large wheels. A little more force, if one of them's slipping in the sand, the other will pull it out. I like that one. And that was some folks in Japan. Okay, what else? I work in the group that does what's called electroradios. These are software-defined radios. And historically, the way JPL has done missions is the computers, like Voyager's computers, literally 4 kilobytes of information. That's what you can, the program you can put on it. So you can't tell it things like, you know, when you get there, take a picture when you can see the planet. Everything is very carefully scripted out in advance and simulated. And it's kind of equivalent to driving cross-country at 60,000 miles an hour. And I want you to photograph the milepost, when you're on Iowa, photograph milepost 367. I don't even know if Iowa's that big. Probably is. So, but you can't blur it. So you have to ready your camera and do the panning and snap the shutter. And you have to predict all of this months in advance. And that is possible, but it requires a lot of labor. It turns out it would be, and the frequencies then for downloading it, what you have to tell the radios is when you're done, here's your frequency, here's your data rate, and now I'm a programmer, I'm not a radio guy, but I work with radio people, so I can use a lot of the same words they do, and I can pass amongst them undetected, but it doesn't mean I know what I'm talking about. So you can ask me about this later, I don't promise to know, but if you're using a higher frequency, you measure what you receive on the ground. That's your signal-to-noise ratio is how well you can hear it. And then you choose a data rate so that you'll be able to understand it. Or, analogously, if I'm whispering, you can't hear me well. But I speak slower, and then even though you don't hear it as well, you get the message. If I use a louder voice, and I'm messing with Jeff in the back on the levels a little bit, if I use a louder voice, I can speak faster, a higher data rate. Fine. We still do all this prediction. We get all these photographs. Think about it for a minute. We get all these photographs from the rovers. How do we get them? Well, they go through the orbiter. Keep thinking about it. The orbiter was sold. These are expensive things. The orbiter has pictures to take. It has its own mission. And you go to the orbiter and you say, you know what? We want to use your bandwidth for their mission. And the orbiter says, what do I get? I got my mission to do. Remember, I got funded and built. But it's all in the spirit of cooperation. It's a good thing. But you want to minimize the impact to them. And if what you tell them is, well, we need to do all these simulations in advance, so it'll be this frequency and this data rate and this, and can you have your operations team put a sequence together that does all that 5 times a day, you're starting to be a little inconsiderate. Software-defined radio means, why don't you just have the radios do a hail and figure it out for themselves? That's not the way we usually do it. The radios didn't used to be that smart. Now they are. Well, they're becoming that way. The orbiter that arrived, Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter, has these smarts. And it also means that we can change the radio's programming over time to add new features. We use international standards. Why do we do that? These are complicated protocols. We don't want to invent them ourselves. B, Europe has orbiters too, and we want to build a network around Mars. When you only send one spacecraft to Mars and it has a failure, very hard to figure out what's going on. The 10-year mission that just, we lost contact with Mars Global Surveyor after 10 years of its 3-year mission. So it was a good lifetime, but we lost contact. We want to know what's going on with it. Well, we've got all those other spacecraft around Mars that can communicate with it. If we use the international protocols, we get the help from Mars Express, which is also there. We can help support Beagle or investigation. So that, again, is a form of open source. That's what electroradios do. So what's the development environment in which we build these things? Again, a CVS code repository in AFS, not open to the world, but it does mean as we extend this product line, it was first built for one mission, which actually was canceled, which is kind of funny. But then we use it for the Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter. It's being used for the 2009 rover, Mars Science Laboratory. And then we adapted the code. Somebody said, hey, I've got the spectrometer. Spectrometer's kind of like a radio, right? We said, no. But the it's not. But the electronics are. So they use the code base for an Indian satellite spacecraft interface. Actually, I'm getting ahead of my talk. The development environment, I guess the point that I want to make here is any Linux box, we compile for RTEMS, which is an open source operating system that's embedded in the radio itself. It's a Spark target. So the point is the standards are very important to us for mobility. Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter just arrived at Mars last March. It was added as a payload. It's a radio, but it's a proximity radio. It's not meant for the direct-to-Earth communications. So it's not mission critical. If it failed, the mission would go forward, which is why they let us fly it. It was kind of great. We already had to patch the software once. Turned out one of the other instruments is... Space communication happens at around 400 megahertz, and computer chips are starting to operate around 400 megahertz, and computer chips are things like moving electrons, and they make radio interference, and the radio picks them up, and that's bad. No problem. We have a software-defined radio. We can put a software filter in to take that out. This orbiter is orbiting Mars now. There's another rover that will launch in 3 years, and new functionality will be needed in the radio for it, so we have to be able to reprogram it. What is that 2009 rover? Mars Science Laboratory, and the photograph on the right is just for scale. Those are the tires of, on the left is the Mars Pathfinder rover that was about the size of a microwave oven. The next tire is Spirit and Opportunity, about the size of a golf cart. MSL is that much bigger, about the size of a Mini Cooper. It's as much mass as we can launch to Mars and get away with the current entry, descent, and landing technologies. They just figured out where's the envelope. Again, always pushing the envelope. How much mass can we send and design the mission around it? This is showing the advantage of adding a new feature to the software. The curve shows under green here is what happens if your operations team on the ground, like I said before, picks one data rate and says, okay, the orbiter will be in sight for about 15 minutes. So set up your link at time one, operate at this data rate until the orbiter goes down over the horizon and isn't visible anymore. The theoretical capability you can get if you can change your data rate is the area under a whole curve, because when it's at the horizon, you've got a very low signal. You can't send it all at your pre-chosen data rate, but you could at, you know, maybe 4 kilobits a second. When the orbiter is directly overhead, you could scream at it at, you know, almost a gigabit a second, and then ramp it down. Why is it a two camel hump? In the middle is when the orbiter is going through your camera mast. From your radio's point of view, it now has to look through your camera to see the orbiter. And funny how your signal drops off when you do that. So if the radios themselves can adapt in real time and say, how strong is my signal? What data rate do I need? It turns out your throughput can go up by enough to meet the mission requirement, which is important, because it couldn't if it didn't. But it does, so it will, so that's okay. Terminal descent sensor. This is what I'm working on now. This is a landing radar on that same spacecraft. So we've got, again, the Electra move to it. Similar digital hardware, and said, wow, that would work for the radar. What does it take to duplicate all this infrastructure? It's Linux. It's C. It's in CVS. It's right there on the file server. Oh, great. And I'm doing this now. I've been working on the code for a month, and we don't have the development server set up yet. I'm just using someone else's development server, using the right code base. So when the new hardware gets in, okay, fine. I'll log into there and keep going. I don't have to move anything. I don't have to relicense anything. Those of you who were here early, this is the video of the landing radar in use. I showed it earlier, but I think it's cool. I've seen it a lot of times. I like it. And Jeff, this will have the sound again. I'm going to pause. pause it a couple times to comment. I said we were at the limit. With previous Mars landers, we came in, you use a heat shield against the atmosphere. The atmosphere is providing pressure, which goes with the surface area of your heat shield. The bigger the heat shield, the more pressure you get, but that goes with the square of the size of the thing. As your spacecraft gets bigger, the mass grows with the cube. The surface area goes with the square. So the force you're applying to slow it down is growing with the square. The force you need to apply is growing faster. Where those curves meet is how much we could... You want to be in the atmosphere as long as possible. You also get time on your hands. So instead of dropping straight through the atmosphere, this one's actually using active guidance. It's built as a lifting body. And it's flying through the atmosphere instead of plummeting. It's the Buzz Lightyear approach to entry, descent, and landing. This gains us a good, I don't know, 2 or 3 seconds in the atmosphere, a little bit longer, which is huge. Finally, you lose enough atmosphere that the supersonic parachute can operate. Drop off the heat shield. At this point, there's a radar operating. It's a tiny little sensor. It's not that important, except it's what I'm working on, so I'm giving it way more airtime than it deserves. But hey. So you're getting range and rate from the radar. The rover itself is controlling the rest of the system. And that's the sky crane, the jets. It'll slow it down. Radar's on a little box out here, looking over the edge. Watch the shock absorbers take that last little bump. You remember I told you the rover was controlling all of those decisions. What's driving this thing now? Nothing. The radar is still taking measurements. It is still providing that data, making it available to the computer that's not on the end of the cut cord. At this point, my reliability requirement has dropped significantly. The only requirement for the whole sky crane is that it not hit the rover. We don't care what it hits, as long as it's not the rover. We were designing for an assumption of little green men that means they can run at a certain speed to avoid the thing coming at them. That's why it's important to lock the thrusters on a steady burn so it gives them the ability to see where it's coming. One of my favorite scenes in Lord of the Rings when they're attacking Minas Tirith and Minas Tirith lobbing parts of buildings. And the one orc sees it coming and he stands there and everybody runs away from him. And at the last minute he steps aside, he sees where it's coming. That's our sky crane. Good example. We know from previous Mars rover that the little green people are very good at hiding from us. Oh, yeah. If? That's right. Chandrayaan is an Indian satellite that has a mapping spectrometer. This image is a little hard to explain. It's a three-dimensional shape. You take one photograph in every color you can. So this is, the spectrometer takes one picture at a time in lots of colors. And by colors, I mean infrared, ultraviolet, near ultraviolet, this shade of ultraviolet, that shade of ultraviolet. Because if you look, if you take sugar and flour and whatever other white powders you're familiar with and set them on a table, you can't tell them apart because they're all white. But if you look at them in the ultraviolet, this one I can see at this wavelength, and different wavelengths tell you different elements. If you look at the moon, it's gray. Well, that's boring. If you look invisible light, our eyes can see a very small cut of the electromagnetic wavelength. A mapping spectrometer uses lots more wavelengths than even we can see, and they choose the wavelengths to highlight, oh, this is titanium, that's thorium, that's vanadium, that's olivine, that's pyroxene. more words that I don't know the meaning of. So an Indian satellite, and they're using the same Electra software base, still running AFS, CVS, all that. Why could we do that? Because it was there. There were some export issues involved. It wasn't a straightforward thing to do. My office mate had to go to India when they were delivering the hardware for that, and she had their medical system is apparently very good in India. She had a mishap while she was out shopping and needed stitches in her forehead. She said, half an hour later, I had my stitches and was discharged. That was the time to go to the hospital, be seen. They took my records, got my name, fixed me up, sent me away. So half an hour later, you'd still be filling out the form here. That had nothing to do with open source, but there's probably an analogy to it somewhere. CCA. So NASA's got this vision for space exploration, which is largely unfunded, but hey, that's enough to do the studies with. And again, when you did the Apollo mission, you just built the radio one way, and it only had to communicate to Earth, and it was better to hard code everything. That was fine. If you're going to, with the new mission, though, you want a lunar habitat, you want a lunar rover, you want astronauts in their EVA suits, you want the reconnaissance orbiter going around, you've got the space station, and you want all of these to be able to talk to each other. People's expectations have grown a little bit since the 1960s. We want to be able to communicate point to point everywhere. They have voice over IP telephones on the space station. And the programming requirement for that was it has to work just like your phone at Houston. The astronauts all have offices there. If this is what you dial to reach your office mate, that's what it should be when you're flying. Why learn a new phone system for 2 weeks? You got enough on your mind. Works great. They're flying it as an experiment, and something like 90% of the traffic goes over this experiment, because if they actually had to human rate it, forget it. You can't do it. But it's an open standard, so they can just fly it and say, well, let's just try this, and the fact that it's used for everything sort of falls out of that. The importance of open communication. Some of you may have heard there was a fire on the space station a couple of years ago, and that was when mission operations goes through Moscow, and they just blocked all information about it. NASA kind of knew there was a fire. Oh, there was a little smoke. We put it out. It's okay. And it wasn't until the astronauts were back on the ground, furious, that they said that thing was burning for an hour, and we said we wanted to communicate back to Houston. What should we do? And the mission controllers forbade us to, and all the communication has to go through that central choke point, the restriction of information. And they weren't prepared to face a public relations problem with their partner industries. So they just stifled it, which I guess is the mentality. And then reported, they had to report something. So they said, oh, well, it is like this. And the astronauts learned that if they talked about it during the mission, that communication just wouldn't go anywhere. So they couldn't. With the voice over IP phones, they're not filtered that way. So they can call their families, for instance, now, and just have a chat with their spouses without having mission control listen in. It's great. So we want the internet in space. We've got these delays, unfortunately. The internet doesn't work so well with certainly minute-long delays. It gets a little iffy with not the internet per se. The internet doesn't care at all. The TCP/IP protocol stacks we're used to are sensitive to these to delays of a second or so, sliding window adjustments that your bandwidth changes as acknowledgments come in. If those acknowledgments take 3 seconds to come in, you're going to have a very small window for a very long time. Turned out there were other terrestrial uses that I hadn't thought about, which with requirements for delay and disruption tolerant implementations. Submarines come to mind as people who are out of touch for a long time, then in touch for a while, or the communications have to be very slow. This program is to identify a set of an implementation of radios that can be used in all of those environments and talk to each other. The requirements are very different. We can't special build them anymore, with a few exceptions. The ones that fit on an astronaut's suit have to be very low power and low mass, but still has to function like the others. JPL supercomputing uses open source software a great deal. I mentioned the lunar gravity map specifically just because, well, for contrast. Turns out my dad's retirement project is to clean up photographs from 1965, lunar orbiter photographs. And the original images aren't really available because they were on mag tape, you know, and if you don't read those every decade or two, they kind of gets hard to read them. So he's working off of photos he saw on the web. He said, oh, I'll just get Lunar and Planetary Institute. Their job was to make low-resolution versions available for scientists. The original mission, I should say, was to choose landing sites for the Apollo mission. So they took the photographs, looked at everything, said, too many boulders, not interested anymore. And they focused on the most boring photos there were, because if you were landing on the, if you were landing a spacecraft on the moon, you'd want the flattest, most boring place you could find, not the most interesting ones. Scientists ever since have been wanting to look through the photos for the interesting stuff. But there wasn't a lot of attention to archiving it. Dad wanted to do it, wasn't funded, so he retired, said, great, now I can do it. I can buy a computer at Walmart that's better than what we had to work with for the whole Apollo mission. And he just he doesn't know anything about image processing. Okay, how do I read these JPEGs? So find some software that reads JPEGs. That was easy. He doesn't work on the JPL supercomputing stuff. That was just a digression because his book is at Amazon. He's working on the second volume. So if you go to Amazon and you look for Charles Byrne Lunar Orbiter Photographic Atlas of the Near Side of the Moon, you can buy a copy of for yourself. And if you email me, I'll get it autographed. I wasn't supposed to do that, but they can't stop me. The real supercomputing stuff. So, math libraries. Again, you want to port your code from one type of supercomputer to another. Supercomputers get obsolete very quickly. I'm told the original definition of a supercomputer was anything that could do a billion operations a second. Raise your hand if there's a supercomputer in front of you right now. So the code's got to move. It's got to be agile. I counted Beowulf clusters about 5 years ago. We were trying to convince the IT organization that maybe this Linux thing was going to catch on one day. They didn't believe me, as it turned out. But in trying to pitch it to them, I counted Beowulf clusters that just my friends knew of. We came up with like 7 of them 5 years ago. I don't know how many there are now. At JPL, I know there are dozens all over the world. There are certainly better ones. But there's a lot. And it used to be JPL had, like I say, one group, one supercomputer, because they were expensive and you wanted to share it among all projects. Now we're seeing supercomputing's doing aeronautical simulations, lunar gravity maps, black hole physics, just in people's labs that are 2 or 3 people. It's really enabling a lot more work to get done a lot faster. Where free and open source software isn't found at JPL, just in my own observations. The business systems. When I do my time card once a week, when I'm good. If I want to change my benefits, you know, select. This is all. They have learned that the web exists, so they're putting all these web applications out, and you have to enable Java, JavaScript cookies and turn off pop-up protection. So you basically have to make your browsers, you have to make your IE browser as insecure as possible in order to do all of this. So they haven't really figured out this whole standardization thing. And when they moved, the previous system literally was a punched card. I was filling out my time by hand. And our time numbers are things like 0IL5S. And my handwriting's not that good, and I pity whoever had to read the thing to tell if is this a 5 or an S or what. And so when they put it on the web, they put a picture of a punched card on the web so that you could type in your number. And you have to scroll over to the right to filling it out, because punch cards are rectangular, and they wanted it big enough so you could see. And they just didn't get this. It's a standard, not a, you know, you don't have to be locked in. Go figure. I'm not going to say that. Okay, so management artifacts. Presentation slides. Why is this talk on open source on PowerPoint? And the answer is because I work at NASA, and I give presentations to inform or to persuade, and you're received better if you speak the local language, and the local language is PowerPoint. The Challenger accident had a presidential commission came back, and in a report that's, you know, maybe a centimeter thick, saying what's wrong with NASA, they say they do all their engineering by PowerPoint. And then, you know, 5 years later, we lost another shuttle. What's wrong? Well, lots of reasons, one of which, well, they do all their engineering in ViewGraphs. We still do. That is the local language, so you speak it. Some people do get open office, usually if they have to read something from management. Spreadsheet applications are becoming tool sets of their own. I was hired in originally to do telecommunications prediction software. As I said, you had to have this the operations team set all these parameters. So we had a Unisys mainframe, and actually I ported that to Sun and VMS. So that was three platforms that ran this the software. Ultimately, Voyager didn't have enough money to stay with the times, so they ran the predictions out to about the year 2020, printed them on green bar paper, the results of what settings to use, and stored the paper. That's what they could afford to do. Good God. I would have been happy to port it for them. But now, that same application for new projects, people just put a spreadsheet together. Of course, why wouldn't you put a formula in it? That starts getting into when I was doing, I had to do software cost estimation for my project recently. And the experts in that said, oh, we have a tool for that. And all they meant was it was an Excel spreadsheet. Great tool, very powerful, did everything we needed to. Didn't run so well on the Mac, you know, because it used a lot of macros and they were slow and we didn't really do our testing on anything other than this Windows machine. So that is still happening. Where is FOSS? Just everywhere. Can't swing a dead cat without running into it. The operating systems, the systems management. As I said, our IT department, I think our IT department officially supports, I saw it, the question is how many Linux machines does it take to run JPL? 100. The IT department is supporting 100 Linux machines. I strongly suspect there are 3,000 on lab. Funny that. In software management, we heavy use of Depo, Subversion, very popular. We don't, JPL has, it's strange, because failures are so important, we have a very good system for tracking them, and very good meaning very heavyweight, meaning pain in the butt to use, meaning nobody files failure reports if they can help it, meaning you need a failure tracking system, which is kind of ironic. So, Bugzilla track. I guess this slide is pretty much a laundry list of what everyone else does. Just a reminder, we have to do all of that common stuff too. And we're very happy to have the open source available to the developers so we can just load this stuff, not build it ourselves like we used to do. Image magic. I did want to tell that. When I said interoperability before, the way I run code now, because it's for an embedded environment, My desktop system has to be a Macintosh because you have to run a Macintosh or PC, which I translate as has to be a Macintosh, but that's just me, because that's what JPL supports for desktop systems, and we have this contract, so you have to, fine. So I'll be working on this. I will be SSH'd into the Linux box where we compile the code with GCC, which then I'll use Timbuktu to get access to the Windows machine because it has a LabVIEW interface we need for the interface cards, the embedded system. Then I'll use AFS to copy the compiled image onto the Windows box so that LabVIEW can send it down to the Spark chip, which is the embedded system, running RTEMS. So that's four operating systems, Mac, Linux, Windows, and RTEMS, four operating systems to make this thing work. And I can do it from home, no problem. This eye chart is just a list of software that's put on every flight operations workstation. Heavily configuration controlled. You don't want somebody to have a different version of Perl than everybody else. So they do a very good job. Network file system, all the things you would expect of a tool support. And it's just a big list, so you can look for your favorite software package later when these slides are available. TCP wrappers, GCC, Doxygen, ASCII to PostScript, XV, Zila. Deoxygen? That's one of those people I have lunch with. I don't use it myself. Have to compile it? Yeah. How do you? Oh, we don't work in environments that have oxygen.
Oh, okay. Sorry.
You were setting me up and I missed it completely. I'm sorry. We have to bring our own with those little EVA suits. JPL, we don't do astronauts. Oxygen bad. Oxygen corrodes your connectors. Why would you want to work in an oxygen environment, for God's sake? And I did want to ask this. So if I get a mysterious compiler message or application message, I always look on Google for it first. Is that looking for the head nods? Give me that. Nobody raises their hand, but give me the head nods. You can do that. Okay. So if Google decides to shut down, are we going to have to learn to work again? Because I don't miss it. Say again. I do worry about it. I wrote a white paper in March, and you can tell from this talk, I have no fear of speaking or even publishing on subjects about which I know nothing. And I had to do the glossary for this thing, and it was all about communications protocols and NASA missions I'd never heard of. So I went through, it was real easy. You go through and you go through what other people have written, and you write down every word you don't know or acronym you haven't encountered, and you make a list. And then all you have to do is solve the list. It's easy. So you go to Wikipedia, and most of it's there. And it was great. This is not open source software. This is communication. This is open collaboration. This is sharing of information. NASA does share back. I give a URL here for our Lessons Learned Information Systems, llis.nasa.gov. And if you select topics, I almost did a screenshot. It's whenever you have a mistake big enough that management notices, you have to prove that you're sorry, so you enter an official lessons learned. Or if you're a good system engineer, you do it anyway. Either way is fine. And you can go there now, those with your laptops, and look up stuff. I grabbed some interesting wording from one. The design and code generation for the control and limit shutdown algorithms was relatively straightforward. Yeah, I work with people like that, and they're serious. But the challenge was to ensure it would all work correctly prior to firing up a development rocket engine for the first time. That's a statement that just communicates right up front. You know, we can do all this hard stuff. I chose, of course, it's literally rocket science. Oh, rocket science is no problem, but how are you going to do this? And so there's really entertaining reading on that website. And if you're bored, I recommend. I probably should have put it up earlier so people, after I bored them, would have something to do all this time. There's some cool stuff in there. That whole metric to English thing, it's in there somewhere. Probably. But you won't find it easily because it talks about management, like contract language and communication failures. Yeah. So, my challenge to you, why do I like giving talks like this? I like coming to the conference just on principle. I've come to the LISA conferences for a very long time. I do think it's some of the smartest and most helpful people. I've never asked anybody a question and not gotten an answer or a pointer or an attempt to answer. So I like being here. But it's the productivity, the Excellent Achievement Award this morning, those of you who are up at the award ceremony, and MRTG, I guess, got Toby got the award for that. And that's great, because anytime somebody puts in open source a capability that I can use, for the reasons cited above, I might want to reuse it, I might want to port it, I might want to share it with somebody in another country. I will always use it if I can. And I want you to do as much of my job as possible so I can do something else. The more of your code I can send to Mars, the happier I am, because there is always more work to do. Think ahead of the cutting edge. Think of what a little bit of preaching to the choir now, but think of what the stuff does now. Think about its performance envelope, and then push that a little bit. Can you make it a little bit faster? Can you make it handle a little more capacity? Can you make it handle more connections? Can you think through those challenging things, because those are the envelopes I'll be at. Round out the total package. If you can give me an automated test suite, then when I port it to the next system, my life's easier. I'm more likely to select that package. Documentation is great. I I do work with people who say, oh, well, the code is the documentation. And yes, I'm perfectly capable of reverse engineering the code. I don't have time. If I'm looking for a tool, probably I'll give it 5 minutes if it looks interesting. If I can figure out what it does in 5 minutes, okay. If it takes me 5 minutes just to start figuring out the build process, I'm busy. Ideally, there'll be the detailed reference guide so that I can look up the obscure knowledge. A user guide that's much, much thinner. Maybe a quick start that's like the little one page. You can learn that from industry. When you get anything from the electronics, well, when I do because I buy simple stuff, it comes with a little one-page sheet that says, we know you don't read documentation, but for God's sake, look at this one, okay? It shows all the red-tagged items you have to remove before this printer cartridge can work in your machine. That's nice. Then a user's guide to walk me through a tutorial and the reference guide for the details. That makes the whole appearance of the code easier. When I talk my manager into, yeah, we really want to use this, and they say, well, is it any good? And I can show them all that stuff. They go, oh, it must be good. Look at all that stuff, all the documentation. It works. Brag about your users. One of the things that makes NASA very nervous is we say, well, you know, we use the following software, and we're the world's largest installation. We do that quite often. We have to do that. We don't like doing that. We really want to be not the first people to use it, because that's risk retirement. What we do is inherently risky. It's a whole bunch of stuff for which we have to be the first, have to be the only. We don't want to add to that risk by being the first person to use your compiler. Right? How often do we upgrade GCC? In operations? Oh, every 5 years if we must. In development? Oh, yeah, when was the last release? And there is a constant healthy tension between those sides of the house. The strength, as you all know, again, preaching to the choir, the people, the community. Conferences like this one, they help the developers a great deal. You learn what features are useful. You get word out about the packages. Keep talking, keep collaborating, keep it open. I appreciate it. I would like to end the talk by thanking you for the hard work you do so that I can spend my time on other things and enjoying the fruits of your labor. My thanks to you. I will take talks, but I still have the microphone. I just want to show you two things, because this is cool. If you haven't seen it, this is a photograph from orbit, that new Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter. And this little dot here is Opportunity, the rover. So we've never done this before. We can actually see our rovers and say hi. And there's the shadow of the mast up there. And we can see it's deployed and it's wandering around. And it's taking pictures from the ground, and we can see what they look like. We want to be in this crater. This is an interesting crater, not least because it's eroded down here. So there's all sorts of strata here. You want to learn the history of a planet. You want to see how the layering of ground has happened over time. Was this layer by water? Was it eroded or was it laid down? So you look for places like craters that expose all that strata. And they're really dangerous. And you can't run your rover down into it because it's got this drop-off that you want to look at. So you need a cooperation from orbit to figure out, how do I get down to there? And we just love it. So that's out there, and you can Google for it. And then this just came in actually during Tom's talk, the previous talk. We're still looking for water on Mars. We still haven't found it. We see indirect evidence. It seems to be flowing. This is a brand new, first-of-its-kind evidence. This shows a crater taken in August of 1999 and September 2005. So in a six-year period, this new little runoff happened in the gully. We don't see the water there now, but we're getting closer. I'm very excited about that. I wanted to share that with you. Just water. And with that, the microphones are still up on the sides if anybody wants to come up. And this wasn't a technical talk, but I'd be happy to answer any questions about NASA or about our missions or anything I don't know anything about, because now you know I'm willing to do that.
Hi, I'm Tim Kirby from Cray. I actually have three notes that I scribbled down.
Oh, good.
Well, a couple of them are
comments.
One of them was the your comment about them printing off on paper, I've been doing a lot of storage stuff recently and worrying about archiving things on media. I'm actually wondering whether we might be better off just printing stuff off and putting it in boxes, because it seems to last a lot longer than a lot of the media. At least you can still read the paper several decades later.
You have some hope, and if you print it carefully so that some future optical character recognition will read it in, all the better.
It's funny, where I'm coming personally,
because I don't generate like images or things that are huge or videos, that's not my job. I just keep it all online, and all these arguments about nearline, online. I used to build systems like that for infrastructure. We have to. And this is another plug for AFS. Why do I love AFS? Well, we put it at JPL about 10 years ago, and I just started keeping all of my files there, even if I was working on some other system that didn't have AFS. That's where I keep the copies, because then it gets institutionally backed up, yada, 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 yada. Disks are getting cheaper faster than I'm storing data. So the number to keep in mind, by the way, is the cost of labor is, you know, your salary plus your benefits plus the institutional overhead, yada, yada. And so on average at JPL, labor costs $100 an hour. So if I copy stuff off to paper and store it, how many hours is that going to take? How much money was that? And it turns out it's just cheaper for me to compress everything and leave it online. And those AFS servers that I worked with when they were young and I worked with them recently, I keep coming and going. basically, I fix it and then I go away for 5 years and they don't maintain it. And then I come back when it's going, when it's crumbling apart, and I upgrade it all. They started on SunOS, then they were on Solaris. They were on, I was the first one that brought RAID into it, and that was great because then the 2 gig disks, the whopping big 2 gig disks, you could put 10 of them together and have one disk partition. It was huge. And of course, now my home directory is that big. So I have found the best archive system is just keep it all online and upgrade your disks, and that forces you to migrate the formats as well. So even if you can't read, you know, the format like that's an image, if you don't have the software to read it, you can read the ones and zeros.
I wasn't being terribly serious. It just crossed my mind.
I'm sorry.
It's
good advice.
And you don't do the human being bit, so I was going to resist the temptation to pull your leg about the discovery thing. I don't know if you saw
the
that.
Discovery thing.
I wrote it down from the CNN report. NASA wants discovery back from its 12-day mission by New Year's Eve because shuttle computers are not designed to make the change from the 365th day of the old year to the first day of the new year while in flight. So either they've got to get it back or they want to leave it docked at the station, but they don't want to be flying while it's doing it.
It's funny to say that we are risk-averse.
Well,
every now and then you have this flashback, like,
oh yeah,
okay, we don't want to take a chance. You do know, right, that when the shuttle is fully loaded, it is the largest armament on the planet that's not nuclear. It is the largest conventional bomb on the planet when it's fully loaded. And you're putting people on top of it. And then these people talk about what's too risky. I don't know.
I hope they pop champagne.
That'll give the filter something to do.
The question I had that came up here, I'm interested in, you were talking about the radios, the radio curve as your busy...
The electro radios,
the
software-defined radios.
I was wondering how you deal with the latency issue, because, I mean, okay, so the thing's turning, but you've got a hellish latency between you and the other end, so...
For those radios in particular, you don't have a bad latency because it's merely the orbit of a planet. You're on the surface of a planet talking to an orbiter around that same planet. So your latency...
Oh, so that's not on the Earth link as well.
That's not
only...
Use a different protocol on the Earth link.
Okay.
Yeah. Good question. Good catch. Okay. Coming to the microphone or just returning? Sure.
Actually expect to find in this mission? I mean, we all want to see the alien artifacts come back, and bones and all that junk, but what do you realistically expect to find with this mission?
The official answer is we don't know, that's why we go.
Okay.
we have never successfully predicted what something would, I shouldn't say, I overstated a little bit. We have never failed to be surprised by what a mission discovers. You do have to have a roadmap, you have to have a plan to follow so that you have something to deviate from. The it's true. You can't just not know what you're doing. We study Mars for a lot of reasons. To me, personally, the most important one is understanding Earth. Because if you try to understand how something works and you've only got one example and you dare not tinker with it, well, okay, we do dare to tinker with the one we've got, but I'm nervous
going
about
back
that
to the
too.
World's largest bomb.
You learn an awful lot looking at a couple of disparate examples. Venus is much hotter than Earth. Mars is much colder than Earth. One has a runaway greenhouse. One has almost no atmosphere. What's up with that? And it challenges a lot of our assumptions. Many of the assumptions about Earth's climate have been disproven in the laboratory of Mars and Venus, where someone said, oh, this can't happen, or it's very unlikely. And we say, look, we got 9 planets. No, we don't.
That's the theory.
Everything's changing in our environment. And it's happened once. So, gee, I think it could happen again. You know, we could never freeze. That one did. We could never have a runaway greenhouse. That one did. So just, it's worth focusing. We are very much controlled by public opinion and by Congress's perception of public opinion. Mars is all about finding the water, because people are interested in life. If you say, hey, life detection, you get news coverage, you get money. In black and white, that's why we're doing it. We have a whole list of other questions we're interested in, and we piggyback as much as we can. The sequence of missions historically, and we get surprised, very surprised by these. So historically, you wing an orbiter out there with a few basic, a camera, again, with many wavelengths, including ultraviolet. Get an idea. We don't know for sure where these things are, how massive they are, well enough for a detailed exploration. So the Voyagers, that class of mission, is just get us some basic information so that we can design the next one. The Apollo program was not just, the astronauts landing were preceded by robotic landers that were preceded by robotic orbiters that were preceded by robotic impactors. The Ranger mission, 9 built, the last 3 succeeded. Or my lab might not exist. Thank goodness those last 3 succeeded. They were just here, hit the Earth, and they landed. They hit, 2 seconds earlier than they were supposed to over the course of a day or 2 long mission from launch, a couple days mission. That's when they learned about mass concentration and, here's an idea. Lunar gravity isn't like Earth gravity. It's not, you can't model it as a point source. Who knew? That gets into impact research. By the time the whole what killed the dinosaurs thing came up, which was only 20 years ago, when the Alvarez father and son team said, hey, look, iridium in a layer all planet-wide, that wasn't a volcano, kids, because there's no iridium in the planet to create that layer. Mm-hmm. Where'd all this iridium come from? Asteroids have iridium. That's probably what it was. They weren't believed. They were laughed out of most scientific circles. But the strength of their argument, the reason they could keep talking, is we had been studying lunar impacts. Everybody knew you don't still have impacts. That was part of solar system formation. You don't see craters on the Earth. There's just volcanic craters. It's not still happening. Go study it on the moon. Look, it is still happening. Land surveyor and then have Apollo take a piece back so you can count how many impacts are happening now. Was it one good test is worth 1,000 expert opinions? And suddenly you look on Earth and you say, oh, look, that was a crater. We just weren't prepared to see it. I'll give you one other good answer. Why science? It's the science as science fiction. There are topics which are difficult to talk about. If you're going to talk about global, and it's not global warming, it's global climate change.
That's what I say, too.
Because we really... What does that mean? It means we don't know what we're doing, but we know we're doing something. I think of it as driving blindfolded, on a mountain road. And you're turning the wheel.
It's not that scary.
Could be good. Could be bad. I don't know. If I don't know, I don't take my hand off. I don't touch the wheel if I can't see where I'm going. But Where was I going with that? If you talk about climate change, people have agendas and they will debate you out of principle. If you talk about climate change on Venus, nobody cares. It abstracts you from it. If you ask, a harsher example, if you ask a child about molestation, you don't ask where did he touch you. You hand him a doll and they point to the doll. They distance themselves from it. If you talk about Mars, you can talk about Earth. You're not helping. those are, and I'd be happy to keep talking with you later if you like.
I got another quick question along those same lines. So what?
I've got another long answer.
Alrighty. So in just this mission itself, just this one that you're preparing for, what do you believe would be something kind of cool to find?
Well, liquid water would be totally cool.
Mm-hmm. Do you believe it's
feasible?
Me
personally,
that we
I want to
find
a fossil. I want to find a fossil of either, and I don't know which is cooler. Mm-hmm. One we recognize, mm-hmm. like, hey, trilobite.
Or a plant or something like that.
Or, hey, I can tell it's a fossil. I don't know what it is. Here's a leaf structure I've never seen.
Yeah, leaf. Do you believe it's feasible in just this mission?
Sorry?
In just this one mission, do you believe that's feasible? You think there's enough battery juice, I guess, in the robot to look around enough to possibly find something? Or do you think it'll take more and more missions?
There's a question you should never ask someone from JPL. So these spirit and opportunity things are going to last 90 days or 1,000, depending on whether you believe us or reality. They're actually becoming a problem, by the way, because there's limited bandwidth. You need the radios to talk to them. And we're actually, the missions that are arriving today, this isn't your question, but I'll get back to it.
Go ahead.
Missions that are arriving now are interfering with their radios. We sent them radios with the same frequencies because we know MERs. Well, they're going to be dead, obviously. Yeah. Radios are the same frequency, and they're operating at the same time, and this is an operational problem.
Conflict, yeah.
But even Spirit and Opportunity could see a fossil today, because I don't know if you've ever wandered around Arizona or somewhere. Yeah. Fossils are frequently just kind of there, and you can observe them. They're covered in dust, but this thing can blow dust off. It found a meteorite. You couldn't predict that. The thing's just trundling along. Again, we put these in the most boring places there are, right? It's like a Walmart parking lot covered in kitty litter for dozens of kilometers because
miles.
It's safe. And it's trundling along, and one of the images had this rock about this big, just black, just sitting there. And when someone friend emailed me and said, hey, we found a meteorite on Mars, I looked at the picture. It was obviously Photoshopped. It was like all those ones with the Budweiser beer caps.
Yeah.
Except it wasn't. It was real. We couldn't have anticipated that. That, by the way, sparked an interest in robotic autonomy, because at the time, the thing was being told, you're in a parking lot, go over the hills where it's interesting, just drive all day, don't take any pictures. What if we pass something interesting? What are the odds of that happening? Oh. Odds
well,
are like
one.
So here's an idea. We don't have the bandwidth to send all the pictures back to Earth. Take pictures constantly. If you see something interesting, where now you get to spawn PhD thesis defining interesting, send that picture back. And that's used to spot dust devils and things like that. So what's new about the 2009 rover? It's bigger. It will be able to go far. It's got more power. So the fact that these are supposed to last 90 days takes all the impact out of this. Because they have lasted 1,000. This new one's going to last a year. So what? You've already done 3 years. Well, we think it's big. And so we can land it in the parking lot, and then we can drive it to the interesting places. Spirit and Opportunity have gotten to some interesting places. Their total distance is still less than 10 kilometers. Imagine, you want to examine the Earth. You want to know all about this planet. So first you land in the Sahara Desert because it's safe. And now you understand the planet.
All the sand. Planets made of sand.
Yeah.
That's cool. Is there time for one more question?
Sure.
Can I ask a conspiracy theory question?
Oh, please do.
Excellent. So, I have no doubt that we did put people on the moon.
Oh, good.
And I have no doubt that we could do it today. But what I want to know, the first one that was publicized, of all the media hype, did we have a person there that put his foot or boot on the moon?
If what? Say again?
Did we have a person that actually put their foot or boot on the moon? the very first one that was publicized as this is the first one.
Yeah.
Is there someone there? Oh, he pauses.
I'm trying to understand. Here's my take on the Apollo mission. The Apollo mission, take it to psychology, because if you're going to do conspiracy theory, I can't debate you with technology. But that's okay, because it forces us to think. Take it with psychology. Why? The whole point of the space race was the United States and the Soviet Union
versus
having a pissing
match. Exactly.
Can I say that on radio? The Soviets admitted that the United States did it. To me, that's proof that it happened. Was there anything found before? You look at, and this will change with time, did they have time to come up with another story? The landing was televised. It was live television. People with other radio, the timeline is, you can't fake, because a radio signal coming from the moon really cannot be faked if other countries, hostile countries, are verifying it. So I could be doing it from a satellite. No, you couldn't, because the angular resolution is
different size of planet.
So you can prove that radio signals, or you can demonstrate that our political enemies knew or acknowledged.
Mm-hmm.
Radio signals are coming from where they said, when they said. And the television of that first moon landing was from a camera outside the spacecraft. So everything they were doing was televised. Now, ironically, we don't have that. We lost that footage.
Yeah,
I'll admit there's a lot of...
I heard about that one, too. That's what got me all investigating the whole thing.
It is spooky. So. And I take the conspiracy stuff seriously, because when I started at JPL, I heard this story about the Mars thing, pictures were faked. And I went down to the archives, because, hey, I work at JPL. I can do this now. And there's this wall. I swear, it was five bookcases of yellow binders of all the Viking photographs. And I went looking through the index... and I said, okay, this one will have Cydonia, the face on Mars. I'm going to go see it, because I'm a jet, because I can do that. Mm-hmm. And I look, and there's one binder missing.
Oh, there it is.
Then I did something rash. I asked the archivist.
Uh-oh.
Now I ask for help. Okay. Who rolled his eyes, pointed me to the other three that had similar coverage, because he knew how to read the index, and I didn't. The photographs are arranged not by where, by orbit. So if you want to find, where are all the pictures of this place? They're scattered all over the place. That was fun. And then he pointed me to the CDs and the online website where you can get the raw images and download them yourself.
All that good stuff. All right, cool. Thanks.
Sure.
You have time?
Oh, I thought I was out of time a long time ago. We got 5 minutes. Speak slowly.
All right. my question is... knowing that NASA's always fighting for funding for missions, like I heard that they were about to whack Voyager mission, things like that, I was wondering if NASA plans to maybe use space tourism as a way to fund projects like yours that don't directly bring in revenue?
Boy, there's a funny question for you. NASA engineers would love to use space tourism, in part because with volume, you get decreases in price and we can go. Dennis Tito, what? Right now it costs $3,500 to get a zero-G flight through, was it zero-g.com or Space Adventures? Space Adventures. You can go to Florida and they will fly you on zero-G parabolas for $3,500, which I'm almost prepared to pay, and I hope they bring the price down more. Dennis Tito was the first space tourist, and NASA, as an organization, was dead against it. The only reason he got to fly is NASA has an agreement with the Russians. The Russians need cash. Dennis Tito did not pay NASA any money at all. He paid the Russians $20 million. And NASA was contractually obligated to give the Russians some number of slots for cosmonauts. That's how that happened. I go to a conference every April, Space Access Society, where people who have their own space, their own rocket companies, private people go and try to get this industry going. And boy, do they have a different opinion of NASA than anyone else. One view of any large government bureaucracy is it exists for self-perpetuation. It consumes all available resources and starves out competition. There are some pretty smart people who hold that idea. What NASA should be doing, in their opinion, and I agree with it, so now I'm not speaking, I never have been speaking officially, but what the hell. extra careful here not representing NASA. As a private taxpayer, here's what I'm seeing from a government bureaucracy, is the best thing they could do is have define the technologies they want to find, issue challenges, and say, we will pay, and I'm not making this up, they are doing about a dozen of these or more, and saying, okay, first company that does, that can demonstrate you can, here's some sample lunar soil. We want fuel on the moon. First company that shows me how to take this stuff and turn it into rocket fuel, you get $100,000, $25,000, something. And as the XPRIZE demonstrated, people will take a loss on the prize just because it's exciting and it's fun, and they get, you know, advertising, prestige, and whatever else. And I really think the lesson of the space shuttle was a total mistake, because, and which we repeated with, I hate the phrase lesson learned, because if you've done it again, you didn't learn it. With X-33, the shuttle follow-on, they said, great, we need it. The shuttle's old, true. We need to upgrade it, fine. Here's what we'll do. We'll award one contract to one company to build the replacement. And they only have to invent like four technologies that don't exist. You don't mix operations. You just don't. You don't mix operations with inventing new technologies. And I don't mean small technologies. These are like composite tank designs and linear aerospike engines and things that just have never been done. And we're going to put all our eggs in one basket. I think NASA should define challenges, reward people, industry, to solve them, and get back out of the way other than that. I would love for space tourism industry to exist. NASA will not do it and is not currently helping a lot, but there are plenty of companies who are. Armadillo Aerospace is one of my favorites, and this is a software crowd, I can tell it. A guy named John Carmack. Does anybody know what software he wrote?
Doom.
Some video game that I've never played. That went fantastically well. The guy is totally rich. He's a wonderful person, very personable. I've met him a couple times at this conference. And he's got a rocket company now, and he's doing all this development. People are asking him, you could lose you can lose a lot of money in this. How's that company ever going to pay for itself? His answer was beautiful. He's a very humble guy, but he's very honest, very open. He says, well, I just budgeted for it, and I know how much money I've spent in Ferraris, plural, the only man I've ever met who uses the plural of the word Ferrari. And they were kind of fun. And this is going to, and I budgeted the same amount of money for this rocket company, and I'm having a blast. He's going to develop the technologies that get us somewhere. Him and the people like him. Okay? 5:30, on time, under budget. Woohoo! Can be done.